On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I want to talk about the three-day weekend. I think that we've earned it, America. I think that we've worked very hard. I think we've produced a lot of delightful cars and MP3 players, and I think that it is come to the point where we deserve an extra day of leisure, where you can spend it improving yourself. Hell, you can work from home if that's what you really want to do. But I think that people should be free to appreciate this short life that we have, a life that is becoming ever shorter thanks to the American diet.
It's not just that we've earned it, like this web commentator suggests. An ever-growing body of research says that a three-day weekend, every weekend, would make us all happier, healthier, and more productive. We're going to talk about that delightful and unrealistic notion later in the show. But first, Volkswagen is offering to pay up to $14.7 billion to pay for its clean diesel cars that were designed to cheat emissions regulations. That is by far the biggest payout any auto manufacturer has ever had to make. The money will go to compensate owners of the almost 500,000 cars in the United States. And full disclosure, I am one of those owners. It also includes a $2.7 billion payment to the EPA for the environmental damage caused by these cars and these drivers. Aaron Robinson is executive editor at Car and Driver. He's back to tell us more about this story, and he joins us via Skype. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. A little happy, actually, that I'll be getting some money. Tell me the details. Who gets how much?
You are a lottery winner, in fact. Not only will Volkswagen buy back your car, but you're going to get somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 for your troubles. So, those of you who bought a Volkswagen diesel, one of the 482,000 vehicles affected by this, are going to get some money in your pocket, plus an opportunity to buy a new car.
And they'll buy back at Blue Book value?
Well, they're going to buy back at the value pre the scandal. So obviously after the scandal, the values of the cars plummeted a bit. So they're saying part of the deal that they're making is that they'll pay the value of the car before the scandal broke. So the problem is that the scandal created a lot of problems with a lot of different people. You've got the Justice Department, who has sued Volkswagen on behalf of the EPA for breaking the rules, basically, the emissions rules. And then you've also got the Federal Trade Commission, which has sued Volkswagen for advertising, quote unquote, clean diesels. And they say that was false advertising. Then you've got a lot of angry owners who've sued the company. And Volkswagen has said they're going to set aside $18 billion to handle all the costs of the settlement. And while that's a lot of money, it's not the largest corporate settlement ever. BP's fines alone for the Gulf oil spill were close to $19 billion. And they say that the whole thing cost them about $54.6 billion. So while Volkswagen's fines are a lot, it's not the biggest ever. It is the biggest for the car industry, though.
Yeah, and still, there weren't that many of these clean diesel cars in the United States, less than 500,000.
And the sum total of the market, it's not that many vehicles. Also, this settlement doesn't cover the 85,000 vehicles that run a larger 3-liter V6 diesel that was sold by Audi and Porsche and Volkswagen as well. So that is a side issue which has yet to be dealt with by the settlement.
What does this mean for cleaning up the environment and all the damage that these cars have done?
Well, so Volkswagen, under the deal, Volkswagen's required to get 85% of the cars off the road by June 2019. So their mandate really is to get the vast majority of these vehicles off the road. So the easiest way to do that is to give the owners a bunch of money and buy the cars back. they say that they will give the owners the option of keeping the car and fixing it. The problem is they haven't outlined a fix yet for the car that meets the regulator's standards. So if you're thinking about keeping your car because you love it, then you may have to wait a while before Volkswagen gets a fix to you. Now, they're saying that owners of these cars have 2 years to decide what they're going to do. We'll see. You know, this all has to be approved by a judge. But they're also giving $2.7 billion of this $14.7 billion to a fund that will look into ways to reduce oxides of nitrogen, which are one of the smog-forming chemical compounds that come out of the tailpipe of a diesel. They also come out of the tailpipe of other gasoline-powered cars, but diesels in higher number. And oxides of nitrogen are a key contributor to ground-level ozone or smog. So diesels are great on the global problem of CO2 reduction. They're not so good on the local problem of smog and particulates. And so that's the problem that Volkswagen is paying to help reduce.
Is this the end of diesel, especially clean diesel, in America?
It was the end of diesel. When that scandal broke in September, that was the knife into the back of diesel. When you talk to Volkswagen executives now, or Audi executives or Porsche executives or any executives from the Volkswagen group, the word diesel does not come up in conversation. They have lost all interest in diesel. In Europe, remember, there's only 480-something thousand cars in the U.S. In Europe, there's 8.5 million cars affected by this. And so in Europe, they've got a lot of problems in Europe. This settlement's only for the U.S. First of all, they have a bunch of institutional investors suing Volkswagen for loss of shareholder value. Plus, you've got movements afoot in the countries, the various countries, to restrict diesel vehicles. In Paris, you have coming a ban on cars 1997 or older. So what the diesel scandal has done is given a lot of impetus to regulators who were not particularly in love with the automobile to begin with to now start to move very aggressively against diesels particularly and cars in general. And so the diesel's effectively dead. All Volkswagen wants to talk about is electric vehicles.
Okay, well, before we talk about that, because I do want to talk about that, I just want to ask you, given all this negative attention in Europe in particular, and the scale of the problem in Europe so much bigger than it is here in the United States, what does this mean for VW's finances? Could it actually bankrupt the company?
Potentially, but my own personal feeling is that the nation of Germany will not allow Volkswagen to go out of business. Remember, the state of Lower Saxony is a rather significant shareholder of Volkswagen. I mean, Volkswagen is effectively a partially state-owned enterprise, and the nation of Germany will not allow Volkswagen to go under. There's too much national pride tied up and too many jobs, frankly, tied up in the company. So if it has to, the federal government will step in and save Volkswagen.
Well, will anyone at Volkswagen go to prison?
It's possible. I mean, there are investigations going on. My guess is that the answer is no, or if anybody does actually go, it'll be a very brief, short time. There's not much of a history of punishing corporate executives for stuff like this. And so I'm guessing that the people who are in charge will get off. Their careers are over, but they will not go to prison.
Okay, let's get to what they want to talk about, and that is the new generation of Volkswagen in terms of clean automobiles. Are they now banking on electric and hybrids?
Yes. In fact, Europe in general now has completely switched. Diesels were always seen as kind of an intermediate step for maybe the next 20 years or so until something better comes along, better battery technology, better hydrogen storage technology. Something better was going to come, but diesels were the intermediate step. So all the attention really in Europe was on diesels because they do get better fuel economy than gasoline cars. But now that Volkswagen has blown up the diesel effectively, Europe is now looking past what they thought was going to be the intermediate step to now the future step, which is electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles, which is a path that North America and Japan has been following for quite a while. And so Europe has some catching up to do. But the diesel scandal has completely affected the way Europe now views the future of cars and powertrains. So it's really been a 180 degree course change for the company.
Well, what do they have now? Do they have anything good?
Well, they have a couple of tentative, you know, efforts. I mean, there's an electric version of the Volkswagen Golf, which is on sale in California to meet the California zero emission requirement, and they've got hybrid versions of the Audi Q7 and some of the bigger SUVs coming. So, you know, the problem is that all of the company's attention and resources were really focused on diesel development, and they kind of had shunted hybrids and electrics off to the side. And that has to do with Volkswagen's corporate personality. They're really Europe focused, and Europe only wanted to talk about diesels until the scandal happened. And so all of Volkswagen's decision making was really about what was best for Europe and not for the rest of the world. Well, this scandal has now forced them to look at what the rest of the world is doing, and now they're running to catch up, and they're behind. They're really behind everybody. So it's going to be a tough few years for Volkswagen.
Aaron Robinson, executive editor at Car and Driver. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you have one of these VW diesels? What do you think of this settlement? And would you still buy a VW now? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach out on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, what it's like inside a private prison. We'll talk to a reporter who went undercover as a prison guard. It didn't take long for him to become an extreme disciplinarian. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. More and more inmates are serving time in private prisons in America. These are facilities run by for-profit companies like the GEO Group and Corrections Corporation of America. And even though nearly one out of every 10 inmates is locked up in a private prison, little is known about what actually goes on inside these facilities. Mother Jones senior reporter Shane Bauer wanted to know more about what life is like inside these prisons. And so he went undercover for 4 months working as a prison guard at Wynn Correctional Center. That's a privately run state prison in Louisiana. And what Shane Bauer saw inside Wynn was pretty shocking. Chaos, beatings, stabbings, and escape. Shane Bauer joins us now via Skype. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. How easy was it for you to get a job with CCA? Because you didn't disguise the fact that you were a reporter. You didn't lie. But you didn't exactly say, hey, I'm working for Mother Jones.
I basically just went on their website, and they have, you know, an application section. I filled out an application truthfully using my real name and personal information. I listed the Foundation for National Progress as my current employer, which is the parent company of Mother Jones. And I basically just clicked some boxes of a handful of prisons among many that to send the application to, and I got callbacks from almost all of them. And the interviews were the kind of interview you might expect from a Walmart or McDonald's, you know, asking things like, you know, if you don't get along with a coworker, how do you deal with that? What was the last time you had conflict, and what did you do? The only question that actually pertained to prison in the whole interview was, what is your idea of customer service and how does it apply to inmates? I basically, you know, just accepted an offer from Wynn Correctional in Louisiana for a $9 an hour position and was getting started in training right away.
$9 an hour.
Right.
That's about as much as you'd make at a Walmart or a McDonald's.
Yeah, I mean, the main employers in the town where this prison was were Walmart, the lumber mill, and CCA. The problem with Walmart is that they wouldn't give full-time employment, so people couldn't get health care. So some of them made the choice to go to CCA. There were a lot of people that had worked at Walmart that moved over to CCA, although there was a time while I was working there that my work partner one morning as we were walking into the prison said that he heard that Walmart had just lifted up its minimum wage around the country. So there was this kind of moment where he was thinking, well, maybe I'll just go switch over to Walmart now.
There's a guy who trains you who says, look, you're not really making enough money to get involved in, to make it worth it to get involved when there is a knife fight.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so
right.
If the inmates just want to cut each other. He says, well, happy cutting.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He, you know, basically taught us that our job was to say to them, stop fighting. And that covered our duties. And he said, it's not worth it to get in the middle of it. Our job is to go home at the end of the day. And there were other ways that the low pay came up in training. They would say, kind of warn us that once we started the job, we were going to realize really quickly that we weren't making enough money for the job and the stresses that it involved, and that we were going to be tempted to bring in contraband for prisoners to make a little extra. And that was happening a lot.
Right, that the guards would bring in the contraband.
Right.
Meanwhile, CCA gets $34 a day for each inmate.
Right.
And they need to show a profit because it's a for-profit company and it's a public company. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem like a lot of money to provide room, board, and security.
Yeah, no, it's really tight. And, you know, this is the kind of core conflict of private prisons. You know, the company needs to turn a profit. They have stocks on Wall Street, and they also need to provide care and security for their prisoners. And, you know, the main way that they save money is in staffing. Staffing is about 60% of the budget of, you know, the cost of running a CCA prison. So, you know, they pay lower wages. When I was working at Wynn, there were significantly less staff than was required by the contract. There were days that I came in to work where 24, 25 guards were showing up for work for a prison with 1,500 inmates.
Wow. And you don't have weapons on you, right? You don't have guns.
No, no, we only have radios. You realize very quickly that as a guard, you don't really have much power.
Yeah, and you have one prisoner who says, inmates run this place. He uses more colorful
right.
language. But
right. Yeah, that was something a lot of prisoners would say, you know. And I would ask prisoners who had been to other prisons in Louisiana how it compared. And, you know, they would regularly tell me that Wynn had less structure and less security. And, you know, I was surprised to hear prisoners say to me, they need to give you guys a raise because that's the only way that this situation is going to improve. That despite the fact that the town by this prison, you know, the average family made $25,000 a year. It was a very poor town, very run down, but they still couldn't hire enough people on the wage that they were offering. People just didn't feel that it was worth it.
So I guess that's why they didn't look too deeply into your background. They seem pretty desperate for labor.
Yeah, they did seem pretty desperate. I mean, there were also, you know, there was one man who had served 7 years in prison himself who was a guard. The head of training actually said to us one day, she said, people say that CCA is scraping at the bottom of the barrel, but we're not. But if you have a driver's license and are breathing and are willing to work, then we're willing to hire you.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Mother Jones senior reporter Shane Bauer. He spent 4 months working as a prison guard undercover at a privately run facility in Louisiana. So with so few guards and so many inmates, you had to form alliances with some of the inmates because they mm-hmm. had to do parts of your job, right?
The prisoners and guards would have this kind of sense of camaraderie sometimes, and they would kind of bond over their frustrations with the company. There was one corrections counselor in the unit that I worked in who, when she was in her office where there was no security camera, she would have two prisoners that she kind of used as bodyguards for her. That was a really common kind of dynamic that you would see in the prison because, I mean, I was in a unit with 350 prisoners, and there was just me and one other floor officer.
Well, you witness, and you're just there for 4 months, but you witness a lot of violence and mm-hmm. A lot of fights, stabbings, and inmate escapes while you're there.
Right.
Stabbings become more frequent.
Yeah.
And it all seems to boil over, and then it's outside corrections officials come in to try to restore order. Does that work?
It was really interesting to see the change. As soon as the state guards showed up, the prisoners changed completely. I mean, there was like, they would do whatever these other guards said, and it really made it clear how little they respected the CCA guards, and they, you know, they would kind of just treat us like we were a joke.
Well, why could they mete out more serious punishment?
I mean, I think a lot of them had been in state prisons, and they knew that at Wynn, things were pretty haphazard. And there was one time that a warden came in. He was a warden of a jail, you know, in one parish in Louisiana. And he came to my unit, and he said to me, "This place is a joke." You know, it was like he couldn't even believe how different it was.
Well, if that place was a joke and it's just one of many, can you extrapolate and say that many of the CCA prisons are run like the one in Wynn?
I mean, there are hundreds of lawsuits against CCA and hundreds of settlements that CCA has made around the country in its prisons for very similar issues as the ones that I saw at Wynn. Inadequate health care. There were suits where, you know, inmates had been assaulted and they were attributing it in part to lack of security. It seemed that these issues were recurring. And I mean, even before I went to Wynn, I knew of a prison in Idaho, that a CCA prison that had been closed down following an FBI investigation that found that the prison was severely understaffed and that there was an increase in violence as a result.
Describe how this affected you. Like I said, you were just there for 4 months, but you write about how you changed a lot.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of the Stanford Prison Experiment, where which had to be called off because the guards became so sadistic.
Right.
And you become much more interested in maintaining your authority. You take things personally. Mm-hmm. You're more interested in order than in justice.
Yeah. I changed really fast. 4 months is not a lot of time, but really within weeks, I saw myself changing. I was becoming a lot more strict. And, you know, when I started, it was like I was a journalist with this kind of guise of a guard. But over time, my energy became much more focused on being a guard and how to get through the day, how to manage all of these conflicts and tensions that were around me. And, you know, I would go home, and at the end of the day, some days I would be kind of ashamed at the person that I was inside the prison. But I would go back the next day, and it was like I couldn't shift it. But it kind of went from initially trying to deal with each person on their own terms, like I would in the normal world, to just shutting off any distinction that I would see between prisoners and any emotion where, you know, I might feel guilty if somebody got punished too harshly or something like that. And, you know, the easiest way for me to get through the job was just to turn off that part of myself.
Do you think, though, that the other guards realized that there, but for the grace of God, that there wasn't really that much of a difference between them? And the fact that they had to be in that prison for so long, 12-hour shifts in many instances, I mean, they were in prison themselves.
That was one of the things that I was surprised by, that I wasn't really thinking about going in. I mean, I went in mainly to see what the conditions were for prisoners. And I quickly saw that the line between the prisoners and the guards was pretty thin. I mean, most of them are from a very similar socioeconomic class. You know, they're really on the bottom. And some of them knew each other, you know, from childhood, prisoners and guards. Some guards had been prisoners themselves in the past. And, you know, guards would talk about, you know, using drugs and things like that. And there were some people that were in prison for that stuff that had just been caught. And, you know, it's like chance that one of them ended up on one side of the bars and the other ones, it didn't.
So after all this violence and stuff goes down and there's an investigation, CCA loses its contract. Another company is running this prison now. Any indication that that company is doing any better?
Well, CCA actually gave up its contract. Oh. It gave up its contract shortly after when I left suddenly, and it came out that I was a reporter. There was some media attention around it. And 2 or 3 weeks later, CCA gave up the contract for the prison. And the only thing that they said about that publicly was in a message to its shareholders that said that it wasn't making enough money at Wynn.
What's been the reaction from CCA to your story?
They just issued a response today. They, in their statement, suggested that I wasn't fulfilling all of my duties because I wasn't reporting the issues that I saw to my supervisors. And, you know, they suggested I had an agenda. But I'll say that the findings that I report in my story are echoed by the Department of Corrections in documentation that they gave to me showing correspondence between them and CCA in which they, you know, complained of insufficient security staffing, insufficient medical, mental health staffing, lack of recreation time. And also, I mean, in terms of me personally and how I conducted the job, I mean, I was selected for promotion right before I left. So people at Wynn seemed to think that I was doing a pretty good job.
Shane Bauer, he's a senior reporter for Mother Jones. You can find his investigation about private prisons at motherjones.com. Shane, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, a new theater production takes on political correctness and what it means to be Muslim in America.
I think what happens in this play happens so that we don't have to live that, so that we don't have to have that conversation. It has been had for us, so now we get to hear it without having actually had to live the pain of it.
My conversation with the director of Disgraced, next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The play, Disgraced, explores what it means to be Muslim in America today. And while the playwright, Ayad Akhtar, won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama back in 2013, the themes are incredibly relevant now in 2016. For 90 minutes, four main characters at a dinner party grapple with identity, politics, and racism in often unpredictable ways. The characters are complex. The main character, Amir, is a secular lawyer of Pakistani Muslim descent. His wife is an artist. She's white. They host the dinner party for her Jewish art dealer and his African-American wife, who's also a lawyer in Amir's law firm. The characters adhere to and undermine stereotypes at the same time. The play asks more questions than it answers, but we'll try to get some answers from Kimberly Senior, the director of Disgraced. It's up until July 17th at the Mark Taper Forum. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks. That was a great intro.
Well, it's great to have you. And let's start with the beginning of the play. It opens with Emily painting her husband Amir's portrait. He's wearing a suit, at least from the waist up. She's painting him after Velasquez's portrait of his assistant, whom Amir points out was Velasquez's slave. And what is her response, and what does that tell you about how she views her husband?
Well, it's interesting because the inciting incident of that portrait happens, you know, before the play begins. But I think it's important to note that they had been at a restaurant the night before, and an incident which is not fully explored in the play of a way the waiter was perceiving this interracial couple, the way this waiter was treating her husband, and what Emily saw in that moment, and what she's attempting to kind of draw out of this portrait, what she also sees in Juan de Pareja, is this sense of dignity and pride. And so that's what she sees. And it's one of the things that makes the play so interesting is that we're seeing characters who are, in a sense, always right. You know, they're both standing by their perspectives, where she's like, this is someone who has dignity and pride. Yes, he was Velasquez's slave until Velasquez freed him, and then he became Velasquez's apprentice. You know, There's a marvelous lore surrounding that portrait. And so Emily is inclined to, from her place, from her lens, see this as what she is. She marvels in her husband, the thing that she respects in him, and how he doesn't stoop to some level. And she's really wanting to illuminate that in him. And he is feeling objectified. He's standing there, right, half-dressed in the middle of his living room on a Saturday morning where he'd rather be going to the gym or drinking coffee or whatever else you want to do on a Saturday morning. And he's not fully understanding what Emily sees. And so here's your first moment where there is a missed conversation that happens in the play, which is actually a series of missed and interrupted conversations. While he's trying to kind of say to her, this is a really screwed up thing that you're doing, and she's trying to say, no, 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 this is how I love you, this is how I see you, this is the mirror I hold up to you. They miss. She's busy in the activity, and then honestly, a page into the play, he gets a work call, and that conversation is cut off, and it never gets played out. And if it did, maybe the play wouldn't happen.
That's interesting.
Which would be sad.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Well, it's interesting that that he is miffed at her for not really seeing him for who he is. But he doesn't really want her to see him for who he is.
Well, you know, that's exactly right, Madeline. So it's the first episode of this seeing, not seeing that happens in the play. You know, in the next incident, right, is when Amir's nephew, Abe, comes and in cahoots with Emily, they attempt to convince Amir to go and visit this imam that they believe is wrongly accused of giving money to Hamas in prison. And that's the next moment where he's feeling not seen. Like, why are you calling me a Muslim? I'm not. I'm not one of his people. I'm not doing these things. I'm in mergers and acquisitions. Like, I don't know about Patriot Act law. Like, how are you missing seeing me? And I think it's something that we do to people that we love. We sort of project our idea of what we want them to be, and then that's all we can see, and that the play becomes a kind of putting on of this mask and then a gradual crumbling of that mask in many ways.
Yeah, but she's really, really invested in propping up her view of Islam as this beautiful religion, as something that needs to be defended at all costs. And she's got a series of artworks that she's trying to get into a show that is in homage to Islamic art. And so she's also not seeing the complexities because Amir is saying, look, I don't want to be associated with this. And she is trying to force him to be associated with it.
Well, I don't want to kind of give too much away in a way, but I think that that's part of the journey of the play that and why it's in many ways so beautifully written is that we get to, you know, due to kind of a devastating crumbling of all foundations and of all structures that we've built, whether they be love or professional or even kind of in a larger sense societal, once those things crumble, we are left among the rubble, and in that rubble can see the bed we've made, the havoc we've wreaked. I mean, all of those things become clear. So I do believe in the final scene of the play, you see Emily's at least beginning of understanding and beginning of her eyes opening.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Kimberly Senior. She's directing the play Disgraced. It's up at the Mark Taper Forum. And I read in the notes in the program that you identify as Arab and Jewish.
Correct.
Was there a character?
Both.
You're both. Was there a character that you initially sympathized with more than another character?
I think at first, of course, I saw myself as Emily. And like, I've had to kind of upend assumptions that I've made and learn a new way of listening and being in the world, which is still one of like investigative curiosity and hunger, but is not from a place of knowing. And I think that that's what the play is asking us to do and that I've gotten to take that journey. So yes, at first I identified with Emily and I've had moments of identifying with Amir and really kind of seeing, you know, many members of my family in different ways kind of turning away or turning towards ideologies or faiths or ethnic backgrounds, and that's been a strong voice for me. You know, and the character of Isaac, the Jewish curator, in many ways is the character I least identify with. I think there's something that he to me is more male than he is necessarily Jewish. And so there's kind of a gender line there for me that I don't always bridge.
There's a point where he says there's a difference between Islam and Islamofascism, which I think a lot of good liberals like to say.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And we would love for that to be true. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And so Amir says, no, there is no difference. That Islam, and he says, I think the quote is a hate mail letter to humanity.
The Quran. Yes, the Quran
the
is
Quran.
one big hate mail letter to humanity, which always lands a tremendous laugh, which at once like terrifies me and overjoys me. You know, I mean, that's the point that Amir is making, and it's a singular point. And is it true or not true? I mean, you know, what is truth? It's one voice, but it's a voice that I think needs to be heard, and especially, you know, what you had said in your introduction about the surprising and terrifying relevance and almost prescience of what Ayad had written many years ago. When we hear voices that are happening in our current political scene and to hear how loud and unpolitically correct in a way they've become, Amir's voice is a voice we actually recognize now, where I think 5 years ago we were like, oh, no one really says that, or you can't really say that. And now he's actually echoing something that we hear, which is to say, like, the Quran is about tribal life in a 7th century desert. And if you were going to be truly Muslim, this is Amir's point, that you have to try to recreate that life and all that that entails, which means that you're willing to fight for it, you're willing to die for it. And that the white characters in the play, and Emily and Isaac, are trying to unpack that, like, hey, all religions are old and we're all trying to figure out how to like live in a contemporary world in many ways. And like, you're not really that different. And that's kind of where the seed of Amir's anger comes, is to say, like, you're not hearing me. I'm telling you it is different. This is what the difference is, because even I, someone who is attempting to remove myself, to renounce my faith, I still feel this tribal identity. He says it's in the bones.
Yeah, yeah. So then he says, when he's drunker and when everyone's drunker, he says there was a part of him that felt pride after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Pride that we were finally winning, we being mm-hmm. Muslims. And so
that's his thesis. That's his thesis. Like, that's how screwed up this thing is, that no matter how hard I try, no matter how much I have rejected this, all of the things that I have put in place, whether it is my job, my home, my wife, all of the structure, all of the scaffolding I have put around me to not be this, I still had that feeling. And at that moment, they're really unable to hear that. And then it becomes, you know, he becomes this sort of outcast in that moment of like, you can't say that. You're an American. How could you feel that way? It's a moment where his wife no longer recognizes him. His best friend and colleague from work no longer recognizes him. And the night really continues to spiral in unsettling ways from that moment. There's no more stable ground anymore. Like, everyone in the play has been completely destabilized.
Well, how does that throw the audience off balance? What has been the reaction from particularly Muslim audience members to that?
The play is unapologetic, and it is one point of view, and it's saying, like, you have to hear that this voice exists. And in a way, it's echoing the voice of Trump more than it's echoing the voice of everyday Muslims in America. I mean, Amir doesn't identify as Muslim. There's something important about that voice being heard, too. And speaking of kind of our art and literature and its role, I mean, Ayad is exposing an ugliness and a rawness and a truth that does exist. It is one truth. It is not all truths. It is not the truth, but a truth that exists in the way that we have seen Isaac's point of it, that's not Islam, that's Islamofascism. So, like, our enemy is Islamofascism. Mm-hmm. And the character of Amir is saying, you have to acknowledge this other thing first.
Right, right. But you're left with a feeling that, my gosh, you know, is nobody safe
it's a great moment. Sorry, I was going to say, I think it's a great moment actually to bring up the character of Abe, the nephew, who comes back in the final scene as Hussein. And in the first scene, we see an earnest, hopeful person. And then the final scene of the play, he has been taken into the FBI and asked questions very unfairly and treated horribly. And that disenfranchisement that he feels, that othering that he feels, you know, he has that beautiful speech that he makes, which is like, we're trying to be like them, to look like them, to marry their women, and they've disgraced us. For 300 years, we've been trying to do this. And so, to me, this greater question of assimilation, what is it that we want? And then how much of our culture do we hold on to? How much of it can we not hold on to? What do we have to do to fit in? These questions and his anger, I think, is very well heard. And the empathy that I feel for him as a young person of a different generation, as someone who's needing to kind of fight back and claim things. I mean, Amir says to him, just get along, just like do what you have to do. You know, you have to show them that you're on their side. And to this nephew, he's like, no, I've had enough.
As you've gone through directing this play and its various productions over the years, over the past 5 years, how did you feel about presenting this side of Islam and of the Muslim character, Amir, you know, ripping the face off his urbanity and exposing this really shocking sentiment that he has? As you mm-hmm. say, audiences mm-hmm. are blown away by it. It's a turning point in the play where he admits pride in after 9/11. Did you feel at all a pang? You said you identified with Emily and her desire to be PC about Islam. Did you feel a pang directing this about and what it would say about Muslim Americans in this time to the audience?
More than a pang, also a responsibility. I feel very passionately about creating work that's putting these challenging questions out in the world so that we can talk to each other. And I don't know that I realized quite how unapologetic the play was until this seventh time around. And I do believe that there is redemption and empathy and compassion in this play, but I think that it happens after the lights go down at the end of the play. And to say, like, wow, I didn't know that that voice exists, and how does that exist, and why does that exist, and let me understand why that voice exists, and what can I do, and where do I fit in? And if you look back to the roots of theater, if you look at Greek theater and the horrible things people were doing to each other in Greek theater and to themselves, right? Oedipus blinds himself. I mean, these graphic, horrific things. And at that time, theater was something that was like teaching us how to live. Like that was a like, let me show you if you keep going on the path that you're on, what is in store for you. To live that so that we don't have to. I think what happens in this play happens so that we don't have to live that. So that we don't have to have that conversation. It has been had for us, so now we get to hear it without having actually had to live the pain of it. Mm-hmm. So I try to look at it that way.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Madeline. So nice to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. That's Kimberly Senior. She's the director of the play Disgraced. It's up at the Mark Taper Forum until July 17th. Coming up on this program, the 4th of July weekend is right around the corner. It's coming up. It's a 3-day weekend, which leads to the question, the obvious question, why aren't all weekends 3-day weekends? Right? We're going to talk about that next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Next Monday is Independence Day, and that means many of us will have the day off. So with a 3-day weekend coming up, it got us thinking, why don't we have a 3-day weekend every weekend? After all, studies have shown that working long hours every week can cause health problems, it can cause relationship problems, and we are more productive when we return from a long weekend. So if we'd probably be happier, healthier, and more productive if we shrunk the work week down, why can't we? Why haven't we? Daniel Hammermesh is here now. He's Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you with us. The economist John Maynard Keynes predicted early in the last century that we would now be working a 15-hour work week. I guess he got his figures wrong.
He got it wrong. In fact, in the U.S., hours of work really haven't changed on average in the last 45 years.
Oh, well, why is that?
That's a good question. What's amazing is in the 70s, we were sort of in the middle of rich countries and how long we worked. And now we're the longest working rich country in the world. Even the Japanese work less than we do.
Really?
Yep.
Well, where did this 2-day weekend idea come from in the first place?
Well, it started off, I think, when Henry Ford created an 8-hour work day in 1914. And then there's a lot of push for it. Indeed, the Haymarket riot in 1886, which created the idea of Labor Day, was over an 8-hour work day. So it goes way, way back. And then in 1938, we passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which enacted 40 hours a week, 8-hour days, and overtime penalties. So it's been around here for at least 80 years everywhere, and the idea has been floating around for 150 years.
So the 8-hour work day, I get that. But where did the idea come from to rest for 2 days? At the end of it.
I think it was partly the notion that in the Depression of the 30s, this was a way of spreading work around. Mm. Since there wasn't that much work anyway, this might have spread it around a little bit. And I think that's where the FLSA of 1938 came about, because of that.
Is anyone now seriously considering implementing a three-day weekend?
Well, look, our government these days can't implement anything very much, right, or enact anything. So while people may be thinking about it, it isn't going to happen. But you got to remember, I mean, if you're over 50, you remember that we're having a three-day weekend this weekend, and that's unusual. And July 4th weekend isn't always 3 days. But it used to be all of our holidays were on the exact numerical day.
Okay. Oh.
So like Memorial Day was always May 30th, I think, until the Monday holiday law came into effect.
So we should count our blessings, is what you're saying?
Pardon?
We should count our blessings, is what you're saying?
Well, I mean, it could be worse. It used to be worse. The question is, why don't we go for more three-day weekends? The notion is, yeah, we'd probably not produce as much. Our living standards would go down slightly, but we'd have a heck of a lot more leisure. And I think most people have asked would take that choice. But you're never really given the choice, though.
Let me ask you this, though, about those two issues. Our living standards might go up if you measure it by happiness. And
well, if you want to measure happiness, fine. That's a pretty sort of subjective measure, which I have some doubts about.
Okay. Well, what about just being healthier because you're less stressed?
There'd be some less stress, but let's face it. In fact, while average hours haven't gone down, they've been roughly constant. What's sad is average hours have gone down for less educated people. The big increase in hours of work is for wealthy people, high-wage people, who complain a lot. A lot of the complaining is done by, I call it yuppie kvetching, is what it is.
Okay. I will kvetch a little bit longer then.
Okay, please do. Kvetch away.
All right. Well, what about in France, where they have implemented a 35-hour work week? Has productivity gone down?
Well, certainly the living standards there aren't what they are here. Whether in particular that specific change lowered living standards, I've not seen anything one way or the other at it. But look, if in fact we believe that if we worked less, we would produce more in total, I can't believe some smart business people, and there are some, believe it or not, wouldn't be willing to implement that. And I just haven't seen that happening. So while our productivity per hour might rise, total productivity would probably fall a little bit. This doesn't bother me. We always have to choose between work and income. And my belief is this country has chosen too much work, especially for high-wage people who are killing themselves.
And are they working more hours at the office, or is it just working all the time at home and at the office?
Yes, both.
Yes, both. And that is thanks to technology.
Well, it's that, but also remember, high-wage people, their wages have risen compared to the average, so they have a tremendous incentive to work more because it's just much more lucrative for them. So to some extent, it's a matter of choice.
Okay. Well, as an economist, if we did decide to go to a four-day work week, how would that be best implemented? Would you just increase the hours for those 4 days?
Well, I mean, one could, for example, go to a 10-hour per day, four-day work week. 10 hours a day seems rather a lot.
But you're saying people are working that anyway.
I think some of them are, better off people are. I think there are better ways of solving the lack of leisure in this country. Most countries mandate vacations. I mean, my son worked for a Dutch company for a couple of years in the U.S. He had 6 weeks of holiday. In the U.S., there's no mandated vacation, and Americans take much shorter vacations than other people. So I think it'd be better to concentrate leisure rather than worry about the occasional three-day weekend. Rather require people and require employers to grant people 1 month vacation with full pay. That would increase leisure, that would reduce stress, and that's a lot easier to implement, I think, than the occasional or frequent three-day weekend.
But, you know, we heard about all these tech companies who offer unlimited vacation, and people just don't take it.
They don't take it because they're worried they're on a sort of a maze and a rat race, and if they take it and the other guy doesn't, they're going to lose out. So until we mandate something, which is what is done in most European countries, I don't think that kind of sort of voluntary thing, take some time off, is going to go anywhere.
Well, also, there seems to be a stronger social safety net, so it doesn't seem as perilous to lose one's job when you are in Europe. So maybe you feel a little more freedom to take your vacation.
A little bit, but also the companies must give you the vacation. It's not a matter of whether you take it or not. You must take it. And also, quite frankly, this is not an economic argument. There is the culture that people take their time off. I look at my Dutch co-author who owns a house in Brittany, and he spends a good 4 weeks every summer sitting there doing some work, but mostly sort of swimming and boating. And, you know, the university is off. The staff is off. Here in the U.S., people just aren't off very much. Even our holidays are many fewer than those in European countries, which I think is unfortunate also.
Does that make you resentful that he's off swanning around at his lake while you're working on the paper?
I'm an American. I'm used to this. I'm 73. I can suck it up. I just wish younger people had more chance to goof around a bit more. They'd be happier for it.
All right. Well, thanks very much. I'll give you the rest of the day off.
Thank you very much. I need it. Take care.
That's Daniel Hammermesh. He's Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Texas at Austin. Always busy, Jolie Myers is here now.
I feel like I should just launch myself into a four-week vacation today. Daniel Hammermesh said it was fine.
Yeah, he gave you the permission.
Yeah,
do it.
Yeah,
you're fired,
boss man.
By the way.
Well, people going on vacation are probably not going to be driving their VW diesel wagons. We talked about the VW settlement today, and we had a listener write in to remind us that some people bought these VW cars used and are very confused about whether or not they get the same sort of benefits extended to them as people who bought these cars brand new. Laura May Meyer-Atkin says that 2 years ago she bought a 2011 VW diesel wagon and has no idea what this settlement means for her. She's going to be looking into it today, but I thought that was a good reminder that not everybody buys those brand new.
Yeah, I think you just get the Blue Book value pre-scandal, no matter what.
Okay,
if
good.
You're an owner.
Well, there you go, Laura May. Thanks, Madeline Brand.
You're welcome.
Of Press Play.
I've been looking into that, as you can imagine. All right. Well, thank you, Jolie Myers, and thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.